Welcome to The Warcast, your geopolitical briefing that tells you what you need to know, when you need to know it. The Warcast is for War on the Rocks members only. Spread the word and tell your friends and colleagues to sign up at warontherocks.com/subscribe.
With so much recent discussion of military solutions to North Korea's weapons and ballistic missile development programs, I thought we'd spend some time today to talk about non-military solutions, specifically the economic solutions. I'm speaking today with Neil Bhatia, a research associate for the Energy Economics and Security Program at the Center for New American Security. Welcome to the Warcast, Neil.
Thanks, Jason.
Yeah, I first would like to commend your program on using not just an Oxford comma, but an Oxford comma with an ampersand, which I think is both correct, but also a very bold move. I like it a lot. It's nothing you see very often in these think tank programs.
Yeah, thank you. I imagine they spent a lot of time thinking about that one and threw in both just to be safe.
Right. More substantively. So you had a piece out this past week, I believe it was, in The Diplomat on countering proliferation financing. Can you give us an overview of what that entails?
Sure. Essentially, proliferation financing is how states which are not supposed to have WMD programs, either because of international sanctions or because they're outside of the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty, basically how they get the goods and materials and know-how to put a weapons program together. So here you're talking about essentially bad actors like North Korea, as you mentioned, Iran, Syria, and then countries in the past like India and Pakistan, which while not sanctioned by the international community, are also not supposed to be or were at the time not supposed to be developing these weapons.
Right. And so how does it work in practice? Is it something like counter threat financing that we do against terrorist organizations, where it's governments working with banks to enforce sanctions? How does it work in practice? What does it entail?
So that's certainly one component of it, but it goes sort of beyond that. And I think it speaks to part of the problem that many jurisdictions have had with thinking about proliferation financing going after it. Because it kind of sits awkwardly between two traditional law enforcement and intelligence priorities, which has been, on the one hand, anti-money laundering, which banks are pretty sophisticated at trying to track down, and on the other hand, export control. So essentially what you have is, you know, if you have a country like North Korea that wants the precursors to a nuclear weapon, it needs to build a reactor. It needs things like high density metals. It needs the know-how to process either the uranium or plutonium. It needs the bits and pieces that you would need to put together for a rocket or for a missile to actually deliver it. And what essentially they do is go out into the legitimate international market, set up a series of front companies, and then this network goes out and procures whatever goods and materials that they need to make the program a success. And I think the most prominent example of how this has worked in the past that I think most people would be familiar with is the AQ Khan network, the Pakistani scientist that, in addition to helping his own country's nuclear weapons program, had sort of freelanced for a series of other bad actors on the international stage, including Syria, including North Korea, or at least we believe Syria may have been one of those countries, but definitely North Korea and Libya. And essentially what he had done is, through legitimate companies, had placed orders for things that are on export control lists, that are considered dual use items, industrial goods that might have one application, but if you drop it in the middle of a WMD program, we'll help you get a weapon and get a delivery system. And his network wasn't, on the whole, that clandestine. He just had the benefit of support by Pakistani military, Pakistani intelligence, and was able to go out and do a lot of these things. And it wasn't until the sort of debate around the Iraq war and what that meant for the non-proliferation regime, that a lot more of this came out into the open and people realized that there was this pretty massive smuggling network working on behalf of many bad actor countries. And that's when they started to think about, well, where are the holes in the international financial system? And I would say probably over the course of the last 6-8 years, a lot of jurisdictions, particularly the United States and perhaps to a lesser extent Europe, have been a little bit better at trying to track this stuff down.
Well, speaking specifically about North Korea, and that's what your piece on Diplomat was on, could you explain to us, how they're managing to finance their program? I mean, this is a notoriously impoverished state, but they seem to be managing to fund a pretty significant development program in both nuclear weapons and missiles. How are they financing that, and how could the United States or an international group go after their financing?
So they have a fairly sophisticated network throughout East Asia and beyond, trusted agents who have been for years working on their behalf to procure a lot of these materials. So as you said, North Korea is an impoverished state for the vast majority of the civilian population. But in terms of being a highly militarized industrial society with a fairly monomaniacal focus on developing a nuclear weapons program, they've kept that part of it fairly well funded. And it's through these networks they've taken what essentially has been money earmarked by their defense establishment for weapons programs and sent it out into the international financial system to buy the things that they can't produce indigenously, either because they don't have the raw materials or they don't have the allied scientific know-how to put it together. You can look at various UN panel of experts reports that have been put together in the wake of various UN Security Council resolutions on North Korea to look at what are called the typologies of proliferation finance, specifically with regard to North Korea, but also many of these other bad actor states. There's a very famous case that didn't actually have to do with the WMD parts of it, but sort of conventional arms buildup. The Panamanian authorities had stopped a vessel in the Panama Canal that had been had just left Cuba and was on its way to North Korea, and they had searched it and they found in the cargo holds a significant cache of weapons. And essentially what their investigation had uncovered was that there was a Singapore shipping company that had essentially set up the transit of these goods and had paid for it using money that had originated in Singapore. So there was no initial connection to North Korea that anybody could find. And that's essentially how they financed the trip. And this case, I think, underscores one of the difficulties is because the only reason the ship had been stopped was because the banks handling the transactions were looking for violations of Cuba sanctions, not of North Korea sanctions. It was only sort of by accident that they realized that this was cargo bound for North Korea. And there are many other examples of especially companies in East Asia, China, of course, being one of the biggest ones, but also Singapore, Malaysia, and some other places where, there are these trading companies or shipping companies, and they've been set up with sort of an initial investment, and they conduct legitimate business for, a period of 6 to 8 months. They're shipping things like foodstuffs or sort of simple manufactured goods that, if you were to look at it at first glance, just seems like another company operating in the Asian supply chain, which makes stuff for the rest of the world. And then all of a sudden, they're going out and buying high density metals, or they're buying gyroscopes, or they're buying a lot of high-tech guidance equipment that has nothing to do with their previous business profile. And if you sort of unspool the thread from there, you realize that, you know, this is a company with a board of directors that are people with Chinese documents, but they're actually North Korean citizens that had been infiltrated into China, and they'd bought false documents and then somehow had made it onto the board of directors list of a company operating in Singapore, Malaysia, or wherever. And, you know, I think part of the problem is that, you know, banks are really good at sort of sanctions compliance, where if the United States or the UN has already identified a company that's a bad actor on behalf of North Korea, they can sort of tell the banks that, and the banks have screening software. They can comb through transactions and find these bad actors. But if you have a company that's completely legitimate at first glance and has been operating that way for a long time, you know, by the time you realize that they're actually up to something dodgy, it's probably too late to have stopped a significant procurement of goods.
It strikes me that this is a long-term effort, and that quick results aren't to be found here. How long would it take to dismantle? Is it even possible to dismantle North Korea's web of illicit financing, or is it much more like going after terrorists and their funding? It's a bit of whack-a-mole.
So I think, you know, if you talk to U.S. law enforcement, which has, I think, been looking at this very seriously for the better part of a decade, mostly because of sort of the high level policy discussions around Iran's weapons programs and now North Korea's, that the best you could probably hope for is to disrupt the network. Because in many cases, you know, the people who are doing this are physically located in jurisdictions where U.S. law enforcement has no reach. So there are people in China, for example, who run companies that on paper are based in third-party countries like Singapore, like Malaysia, other places in Southeast Asia that control transactions stretching into Europe or even into the United States. It's very hard to, or actually it's impossible really to arrest those people or detain them, because they're Chinese citizens, and, you know, the long arm of the U.S. law doesn't reach that far, and you sort of settle for the next best thing, which is to sort of let the network know that you're onto them, where possible, get the money, which is where I think the U.S. government has built up a lot of skill and a lot of authorities in going after bank accounts of some of these networks and sort of crippling the companies that way. But as you said, it's a long-term process. It takes a lot of investigatory resources. You need very close cooperation with international banks, and the banks themselves have to be fairly sophisticated at looking for patterns of activity. And there are a lot of big banks who are well-resourced that can do this. But if you have a small regional bank or a small national bank in a jurisdiction that has no experience with trying to enforce UN Security Council resolutions on non-proliferation, it becomes incredibly difficult.